Hi, everyone, and welcome to our weekly Insomnia Discovery Q&A. Coach Aline is with us. Welcome back.
Hi, Daniel. Hi, everyone.
How are you today?
Amazing, amazing. How are you?
All right. I'm good. Very good as well. And as you know, Alina, as we're waiting for questions to pop in, we'd like to talk about something. And you said, why don't we talk a little bit about the video you had yesterday, which I think was there's so much fascinating things about that. But what are your thoughts when you saw that or heard about it?
I mean, first of all, I was so like, I would say many people who are watching this, they would be so grateful that you're actually doing this work, you know, demystifying all the, you know, latest findings and research and all those loud headlines that can trigger a lot of people. And I actually, it's so funny because like you made this video about this research. And also a couple of days ago, my friend, like whom I recently talked about, like that I'm now coaching, people with sleep issues. And then he sent me this, the article based on the same research, but it's in Slovak. And I thought like, yeah, it's probably like another one, like, which is like, you know, alarmist articles. But then after I watched your videos today, and then I just like, was wondering whether it was the same research, and it was actually. So it was like really big, kind of like it made a lot of noise. It made a lot of people anxious. And I think the way how you broke it down in that video is really, you know, comprehensive and very well explained, because, you know, when person just reads, like people who sleep less than 5 hours, then they are like, you know, have increased chance of all cases of, you know, also all sorts of diseases, of course, is going to be, you know, like, be triggering. And then when you actually go deeper in that and you look into the I would say section where no one actually looks, which is, you know, in the research studies, what was it like, what was the section name?
Yeah, it's the it was deep into the results.
Limitations.
Yeah.
Limitations, right?
Oh, limitations, yes.
Yes. And this is where the actual truth, like this is where the most like substantial stuff is hidden, which can explain everything. But because, you know, people kind of like hunt for something like very dramatic, very like news-making headlines, they are going to easily kind of like replicate the same message over and over without actually understanding what that study really said. So I think that the job that you're doing is really important. And I hope that at some point, you know, your videos or your this kind of like breakdowns will be discovered by a broader community, like scientific community, and really would be recognized for, you know, the proper interpretation of the data, of the findings.
Yeah, is, you know, and by the way, Rahul, we see you're here having some questions. That's great. Anybody that's here has questions, please post them and we will get to them in a second. But yeah, I hope so too. You know, when I first saw this one, I was like, okay, this is probably the same old, but then there was a little bit of difference because this was like prospective. They had a kind of a longitudinal data. And so at first I was like, okay, is this something new here? And it quickly saw that there wasn't anything new, but did you, I'm sure you watched the whole thing. Did you get to the part where they had like objective data and accelerometer data and all that stuff?
Yeah. That was actually like more, like it gave even more kind of like understanding of the real, you know, the root of the issue. And yeah.
It was really, I mean, it really struck me when I read that part, because it's like, they're talking so much about this, like the questionnaire data, but then they actually did have objective data, which showed nothing. And it was kind of shocking to me.
It's so, like, you can see how people just say, okay, there is this, the same kind of like the similar pattern in the graph, and therefore it's basically the same issue.
Exactly.
I'm not realizing that this kind of like the extreme on both sides of the extreme, it's actually not that significant number. It's just the shape of the graph looks similar. So therefore they kind of conclude that it's like, yeah,
it's all the same.
Like exactly. Yeah, it's all the same, just like as with anyone who reports it. While in reality, like there are some things, like I always kind of like refer to this studies about paradoxical insomnia, because for me, to be honest, when I learned first time, I learned about such thing as sleep state misperception. For me, that was a big thing, because it kind of like resolved a lot of anxieties, because I thought that I am not getting enough sleep because I don't, I remember myself like almost whole night just like thinking and I'm not sleeping, and then yet somehow I can function during the day. I don't feel sleepy during the day or in the evening. So it was like so triggering for me. So I was really scared that my body is not getting enough of sleep. But when I read about that kind of like the misperception of sleep state, it kind of put things together and really calmed me down, because finally I found the explanation to my, you know, surprising wakefulness after sleepless nights, after several sleepless nights in a row, was actually my brain kind of not registering the sleep part, basically eating it and just, you know, thinking like I didn't sleep. So, and then you see how, you know, it's well studied and people actually tend to underestimate the number of hours they get, like people with insomnia. Well, the opposite is also true. Like there was interesting study where people who's like the good sleepers, they actually overestimated how much they slept. So they could say like, oh, I slept like 7 hours, and in reality the machine will show something like, I don't know, six and a half or something like this, right? So it's also subjective, and it's good. I think it's, for many people it can be that kind of piece of information that can really calm them down.
Yeah, no, that's true. I've heard that so many times, even people saying like, oh, you know, I thought I didn't sleep at all, but my partner said I was snoring, and just that knowing that I did sleep more than I thought, that can often be so reassuring, right?
Yeah,
totally. And final note on this that I want to share was that, more and more people are sending me links to like various studies and things out there. And when I see them, I'm like, oh my gosh, we should comment on this. Oh my gosh, we should do this. But this is too much. And it's impossible to comment on every one. And it's a little bit of that feeling like there's a huge wave and all you can do is like a little bit here and there. But hopefully the things will turn and things of that nature. But anyways, we're doing the best we can. All right, let's jump in. And we have some questions here. Rahul is with us and is asking the follows. Hi, coach. I'm getting hypersleep, but falling asleep easily or early. But when I fall asleep, it's always hypersleep. How can I get into deep sleep? And then also, is that improvement? Is the question. And common question, common scenario. What are your thoughts when you hear this, Alina?
Yeah, it's also a familiar scenario for myself as well. And I would say that for me, as when it also was kind of like before, it was like no sleep. But then I started kind of getting of this kind of hypersleep, because I was like really not sure whether I slept or not. So it was kind of like, you know, I didn't know how to explain it or whether I can confirm that I was sleeping or not. So at some point, I actually noticed that this was a part of the transition period where, you know, there was not so much hyperarousal, yet there was still something that could make the sleep seem shallow. So I would say that, you know, it could be the sign of like of improvement, but also we can look at it as something like that hyperarousal changes the shape or its form. Basically, at some point it could look like let's say full alertness. And another, you know, after a while, it can look like, let's say, heart palpitations or piping jerks or anything like that. And then with time, it kind of changes the forms. And what I notice is the more we focus on that, when we think, oh my God, I have hypersleep and it should not be happening, I'm not okay with this. This is usually when that experience keeps happening over and over. And this is usually good to go the path of, you know, accepting that state, like taking it as a part of the journey, as a normal part of the journey. We all experience that. And I also talk to many people who are going through the same experience. So, and I notice how the more welcoming they are, like to that experience, the sooner it kind of passes. And they don't even notice when it kind of like transitions to like a deeper sleep. And, you know, then they feel like, okay, then, things are moving. But yeah, it might not happen instantly that I accept the state and therefore I expect that it will leave immediately, so that night I will be sleeping like as I expect. It doesn't happen that way, but I would say the gradual acceptance leads to hyperarousal kind of changing its intensity and also changes its form.
Well, super well said. And generally speaking, to answer Rahul here, generally speaking, I do see it as like a step towards where you want to be when it goes from like this intense hyperarousal where we're clearly awake, like we think we're clearly awake the whole night, to this hypersleep. Yeah. It's kind of a step towards it fading out. So that's, I think that's generally speaking nice. And it also reminds me of another question that I haven't gotten lately for some reason, but it used to be a very common one, which is like, oh, I had trouble falling asleep. Now that's better, but now I have trouble staying asleep instead. Like, oh, yeah. What am I doing wrong? What's new? Which is, again, when we think of it as like, oh, I overcame this, but now I have a new problem, then there's some struggle. But when we see like, no, it's just the same thing manifesting in different ways. And the way that one thing faded away is going to be the same thing the other fades away, which is, again, like not fighting against it, understanding it, leaving it be. So yeah, little comment there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very nice. Peace is with us as well. And welcome back. And thanks, Rahul, as well, of course, for being here. Peace says, if one day a reliable study proves scientifically that a causal effect relationship exists between lack of sleep and a certain chronic disease, how can the brain deal with this trigger? Very interesting question. Very interesting question. And something that I've pondered, actually, because, like, you know, what if somebody actually shows this? Like, what do we do then? And to me, it actually doesn't change that much, because if we say that, again, I want to point out that this has never been shown, but if we just, for example, say that there's a big study shows that, okay, a big study, they did kind of the impossible. They did the impossible. They took like 2,000 people and kept half of them sleep deprived for like a year, while the other half slept, you know, as much as they would normally. And they show that only the sleep deprived developed, you know, a toenail infection. I'm just going to say that so it's not so triggering. A toenail infection, right? What do we do then? Like, what do we do with that information? Well, it actually leads to the same place. Because if we think like, oh no, I can develop a toenail infection if I don't sleep enough, I gotta sleep more. Even if it's true that you do get a toenail infection if you sleep more, if you don't sleep enough, it doesn't change anything. It just becomes like more of like, okay, I have to accept that if I don't sleep enough, I am going to get a toenail infection. And there's nothing I can do about that. I can't control it. It leads to the same place, even if it's somebody would show this impossible thing. But what do you think, Alina?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I just want to maybe like to continue to develop this like hypothetical scenario. Okay, let's say they do like sleep deprive certain amount of people. Then how realistic is that to actual circumstances in life? We should get into very strange circumstances where we are sleep deprived by external factors. Usually our body is so much, you know, I always say like our body is kind of foolproof. That's the thing. We think that something can take or keep us sleep deprived for a very long time. In reality, even people who are really like work hard and, you know, let's say have several jobs and so on, at some point they are going to crash, like, you know, they're going to sleep. So I would say the body will not let us, you know, starve ourselves from sleep. So, and that's why, you know, of course, yeah, like if there is something like this, that yes, this kind of something happens, like someone keeps you awake for, I don't know, a month or something, that kind of like seems very improbable scenario, some like maybe dystopian or whatever, like punishment, I don't know how to call it. Then again, also acceptance and everything is like, yeah, like, you know, then, you know, if someone gets, let's say frustrating news, they can fight with it or they can accept that they cannot, you know, change something. But I would say again, like not to trigger people here, like that in reality to get this condition where we are like not sleeping, first of all, it's like difficult technically to execute. Who would be the one who would keep us awake, like on purpose? And also always know that our body is much smarter than we think it is, because it will not let us starve without, you know, without sleeping. It will eventually get what it needs, whether we want it or not. So yeah. I would say even to modulate that kind of study seems impossible to do that. Not considering that it will be extremely inhumane, but I don't know if that answered the question, but yeah, that's my thoughts.
No, it makes total sense. And I hope you agree, Peace, and that our reply there was satisfactory.
I would also
go ahead, Lina.
Maybe like to trace back what part of you asked that question. whether it's the one with, that looks for the kind of bad news, you know, maybe it's the automatic part of the brain that wants to kind of come up with another thing to worry about. Just maybe investigate the nature of that question, which can also, again, like, give us more understanding what is happening and how the brain tries to sneak in attempts to, you know, come up with a reason to keep problem solving. So just kind of like, I think it's good to be aware of that as well.
Yeah. No, that's very, very true. Not at all. Very nice. Nicely put. Somebody's vacuum cleaning behind me. If somebody hears that, hope it's not too disruptive. Yes, Amy's here as well and says, hi, Daniel. I had a bad night last night. I'm trying to get off my sleep aid I've been taking for years. Well, last night I had 2 hours of sleep only. It took me a while to fall asleep, but then I woke up and it took me 3 hours to fall back asleep. How can I get through this? All day I keep thinking of how I'm going to get to bed tonight. Amy's had a rough day and wonders sort of how to cope, how to get through the day. What are your thoughts when you hear this, Alina?
I would say it's normal reaction from the brain to feel more triggered when we take away safety things and safety or safety nets. And the safety net in that case could be that sleep aid. Because in a way, yes, like one part of why we take sleep medication is to trying to fix sleep or try to make, you know, initiate the process of sleeping. But at some point that kind of pill becomes like a last resort or safety thing. So sometimes even if we are aware that sleep in itself or sleeping pill in itself does not produce sleep, we still treat it as something that is like, okay, like some sort of safety thing we can do for ourselves and just to, you know, ensure that we are going to be all right, at least to know that we did our best, you know, to cope with that situation. And when we take it away from ourselves, of course, the brain is going to react to it as something like, okay, what are you doing? Like, you know, you have to keep protecting your sleep and you are doing the opposite. So of course, like the short-term anxiety tends to increase when we do the, you know, make steps towards more courage, doing things, the opposite things, what the brain tells us. So it is normal. And I would say maybe, maybe consider also here the, how to say, like attachment to knowing what time it is, because sometimes that can itself can be triggering, because I would say like, okay, I had 2 hours of sleep only and then 3 hours. So there might be a bit of more, how to say, focus on the performance part, which of course can also increase the anxiety in itself. So I would say really understand where that hyperarousal, where that anxiety comes from. It normally comes when we do some changes in our lifestyle or we stop taking something. It's going to be treated by the brain as potential threat or some uncertain situation. So of course it's going to make or try to send us more signals like, okay, be careful right now. You have no safety net, so make sure you sleep and so on and so on. So I would definitely think about that.
Yes, very, very well said, Alina. And you know, you talked about kind of like how when we remove something that the brain has thought of as safety, like we naturally become more scared and that can keep us awake, of course. And the other part of this question is kind of like, how do I get through this all day? I keep thinking about this. I would say like, it's hard. I haven't, you know, the most kind of helpful I've found when it comes to like when we feel like really maybe defeated, we're scared, we feel hopeless and things of that nature, it is really self-kindness. That maybe it's not necessarily easily available to us, but if we can just do something, a little nice thing for ourselves, maybe, you know, we have a treat or like we take a long bath or we take a walk or do something that's just some nice kind thing to ourselves, I think that can make things a little bit easier. But when people ask you about this, like, I feel, you know, I feel so defeated, terrible, tired, et cetera, during the day. What are your go-to answers, Alina?
Yeah, I want to kind of like maybe digger into why they feel that way, because then we can actually address the root of it, not just how to deal through the day. Because I would say like the answer, like being kind on yourself during the day is like really good, you know, advice, because that's how, you know, when we are more like, you know, unkind and judgmental towards ourselves, of course, we are going to put more pressure. But I would say like the reason why we keep thinking about that especially when we're in transition of getting off the pills, or let's say, let's take any other scenario where, let's say, circumstances change. We have to go on a trip, or someone comes to visit, or something like that. Any change is going to be met with this kind of hyperarousal signals from the brain. And what I want to kind of like highlight here is that sometimes it is the feeling unfree to provide comfort for yourself, just knowing that you cannot take a pill, you're forbidden from taking a pill, you are not allowed to do something, it can become limiting in itself. That's why I'm more like, maybe, how to say, proponent of more like subtle and more gentle approach when it comes to making changes. Of course, like, I'm not like advising anything here, but let's say like how I approached my personal, like, you know, when I was, let's say I was taking like also sleep medication for a while. And then I also felt uncertain about like leaving them behind, like not taking them. At some point, what I did is that I allowed myself to make a decision on a particular night. So not a, like, it's not about like making decisions for the rest of your life that, okay, since this time, I'm never going to take sleep medications, or I'm going to take less and less of them. But I allowed myself to make a choice every night and not to regret that choice, or to allow myself to make any sort of decisions and stand by that decision. And what led me to, or let's say what followed after, was that I felt more at ease, because I know that I have here like my safety net. If I want, I will take it. If I feel like I can stay, you know, I can handle the hyperarousal, I will not take it. But I felt free to choose. And that kind of knowing that you are not the, like, the prisoner to the situation actually helped me lower the overall hyperarousal. And what I noticed is that the less limitations I had, the less likely I was to resort to that, you know, safety measure. Because I knew I can take it whenever I want. And just knowing that already put me at ease, because in reality, nothing matters when it comes to sleep. Nothing can create sleep. So whether we take pill or not is not going to actually, you know, predict how the night will look like. But knowing that we are not allowed to take something can already create the, you know, the inner pressure. So I would say, really kind of like, maybe think also in that kind of sense, that just explore the concept of freedom at night, that you can choose whether you want to, you know, resort to safety net, or you feel like brave enough to, you know, to go without it, and do it like every night, basically. Not decide for yourself for the next 2 weeks, but actually every night make it like a blank slate where you just make a decision, new decision every time. I don't know if that makes sense, actually.
No, it makes total sense. And I think, you know, maybe, you know, people who hear this may be kind of confused, because they say, hey, Daniel, you always say like, don't treat it as an experiment, but treat it as a decision. But I think that there's actually no conflict here, because I think we see this very similarly. I think if you want to come off sleep medications, then that can be like, you have decided that you're going to come off sleep medications. But if you sometimes still take them, that's just an act of freedom and an act of kind of self-compassion for that particular night, as you say. And so this reminded me actually of somebody, I forgot his name, but randomly asked me here on the YouTube comments, like, about, he wanted to stop smoking. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I wonder like how our thinking, you know, can fit in there. And basically what I said was like, I'm not a smoking counselor. Like, I don't know expertise, but how I think about it is this. If you tell yourself, I have to quit smoking, I'm a bad person if I smoke, it has to happen now, this is it, I'm going to power through this thing, then it's going to be tricky, because all that pressure to come off is going to create, like, you know, a situation where it's really difficult. But oddly, it's like when you say, yeah, I smoke today, and that's okay. You know, I want to quit smoking, but if I smoke today, that's okay. It doesn't say anything about who I am. And he, like, you know, 3 weeks later, he said, I stopped smoking. I don't know what happened later on, but I think it worked. So I think it's the same idea. Like, if we pressure us to do something, it actually becomes harder. Oddly, when we give ourselves freedom, I think, you know, things become easier.
Because that's not about actually like that now you will take for the rest of your life those pills. It's just at some point when you realize that you can handle both, you know, like, let's say, discomfort of a hyperarousal, but at the same time, you know that you can be kind enough to yourself to provide yourself, you know, comfort whenever you need it. And if that comfort looks like resorting to sleeping aid, like there is nothing wrong about that, because exactly. In the end, it's not what makes sleep happen. It's knowing that you are not pressured, you're not threatened to sleep. That's when sleep happens. It's not the actual, like, you know, some chemical that we consume that creates sleep in itself. So I would say that would be tricky if a person did not have the education background on that. That would be tricky, because they would still have this kind of hope, okay, I will take it and it will work. But when a person knows that there is no actual, nothing external can produce sleep, then we are become kind of free, because nothing can produce. Not taking a pill does not produce, just like not, or wait, taking a pill does not produce sleep, just like not taking a pill doesn't produce sleep. Yes. So just that's where the freedom comes from. And of course, like eventually you will find that there's no need in taking pill, but you will do it because you don't see a point in it, not because you feel, you know, pressured not to take it, if that makes sense.
That makes so much sense. Yeah. Super nicely said. All right, Amy, thanks for being with us today. And let's check in with Marcus as well. Marcus said, for the last few years, I can only sleep 90 minutes tops with really intense dreams. I'm exhausted nonstop. It's hard getting to sleep, but harder each time I wake up. Sorry to hear this, of course, Marcus. And, when I hear this, when I read this comment, I'm thinking, this, you know, we already talked about kind of the time focus on time when we're kind of keeping track of how many minutes we sleep how many cycles we had and things of that nature can make things tricky. So like this timeless approach can really help, I think. And also just like the general education about like hypersleep and like I'm looking at the comment as I'm talking, like hypersleep and also being exhausted, how that can come from like what we call battle scars and emotional fatigue, all that thing I think can really, really help. So I would just encourage you, Marcus, and anyone else in a similar situation, to just spend some timer and check out the playlist and get that foundational education. Things will happen easier. Let's do one more. Let's look at this one. Brandon says, is it normal to experience a sensation in the chest as night comes and bedtime approaches? I find myself having dreams almost every night, but my sleep is broken with micro naps. I almost expect to have a struggle. Isn't that a form of acceptance? Let's look at this first one. Is it normal to experience like a sensation in the chest as the night comes and bedtime approaches? Of course, nothing medical advice here, but just sharing our general thoughts here. What do you think, Alina?
I mean, I also had sensation in chest when I was like scared. It was more like this kind of, you know, pulling like something down. Like, it's like, I don't know how to explain it, but it was more like when suddenly I realized that, let's say, oh my God, it's already, you know, evening. And then it was like, oh, like I feel the tension somewhere in this kind of solar plexus or something. Sometimes it was kind of moving. Like sometimes I felt it in stomach, sometimes in chest, sometimes it was in hands. So I would say like, the hyperarousal, the fear response can appear in many places. And usually it happens where the nervous system goes, you know, this vagus nerves and everything. It's like, if it appears somewhere due to the response to, let's say, some trigger, I would say that we can look at it as manifestation of hyperarousal. And it can show up in any, you know, in any place. For me, it was migrating, basically. Sometimes I felt anxiety in stomach, in chest. And then at the end, I started feeling them in my shoulders, which was super unpleasant. I really hated that. But I would say that, yeah, it's kind of like one of those cases when we begin to reject it, or how to say, like resist it, try not to have it. It's usually when we kind of keep, you know, experiencing it more and more, and we begin to focus on it. We develop fear of it, of that feeling itself. So just knowing that, you know, that it could be happening from like as a, you know, hyperarousal response could really help. But yeah, but as you said, nothing medical advice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't totally know what kind of sensation is chest like we are talking about here, but
spin off of that, like, you know, some type of like pressure on our chest and things from the chest often are something we experience when we're scared. And one last thing to add here is I like this teaching around context, that if you're watching a soccer game or something like that and it's really intense, and if you stopped and take a look at how you're feeling, you may have a pressure in the chest, you know, your heart may be beating fast, you know, but you don't think it's strange because it's in context, you understand why. Yeah. But when we're kind of like it's beginning to become dark outside, and we're not fully aware that, okay, that is triggering me now. I'm starting to become scared of the night, and we feel a pressure in our chest, and we're like, oh, maybe this shouldn't be there, because there's no obvious reason why we should feel that way. But when we see, yeah, like there is sort of an obvious reason, we are scared of the night that is approaching, and we're like, oh, of course I'm feeling this. I think that often helps a lot. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining today, Alina. Hope you have a nice rest of your night. And thanks everyone for being here. We'll see you next Wednesday or sooner.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.